So yesterday we were dealing with the 35th verse of 3rd chapter. So here, the sage Pipalayana is expounding the highest non-dualistic philosophy. The question put to him by the king was, with regard to the absolute reality, what is the nature of Brahman? What is the absolutely real? That was the question. So first, he said, sthiti udbhava pralaya hetuhu. That's the first term. It means that reality is the ultimate cause of origination, existence and dissolution of the universe. Just as gold is the cause of origination of ornaments, of golden ornaments. Gold ornaments originate from gold. And when they exist as ornaments, then also they are not different from gold. And then if you melt it, again it goes back to gold. So these ornaments are nothing but manifestations of gold in different forms and in different names. That's all. In Sanskrit we call nama rupa, which come and go. If you melt it, you can make another variety of ornaments. Ornaments can come and go. Their shapes and forms and sizes will change. Names also will change. So also the entire creation is nothing but the manifestation of the absolute reality in different forms and different names. So, if you are talking in terms of cause and effect, we have to say that Brahman is the efficient cause and Brahman is also the material cause. That is a special characteristic of Advaita philosophy. See, material cause, you know, clay is the material cause of the pots and pans made of clay. Gold is the material cause of golden ornaments. Goldsmith is the efficient cause. So, with regard to the world, Brahman is the efficient cause. Brahman is also the material cause. So, before the world came into existence, it was Brahman. And when it gets dissolved, it is Brahman. And when it exists in association with name and form, it is Brahman. Of course, when you look at the world devoid of names and forms. So, that's why first the sage says, Brahman is the hetu. Hetu means cause. Efficient cause and material cause of the origination, existence and dissolution of the universe. But then he says, this Brahman is not caused by anything. It is not the effect of anything. It is cause. In reality, if you go one step further, Brahman cannot be called the cause. That is from a philosophical point of view. Because the world really doesn't come into existence independent of Brahman. So how can you think of Brahman as the cause if there is no effect? In a way, the forms and pebbles and waves of the ocean cannot be said to be the effects of water. Because when you talk about cause and effect, you have to remember the effect has got some difference. Meaning it has got a different status of reality from cause. But in the case of forms, waves and pebbles, they have no independent existence, independent of the existence of water. Similarly, the golden ornaments have no independent existence. So that's the idea behind. But this is the higher Vedanta. That's why in Vedanta, which is being expounded here, there are different levels. From an empirical point of view, this world is caused by Brahman. But then, from a philosophical point of view, this world is a manifestation of Brahman in association with name and form. From an experience point of view, the world is Brahman itself. That is why you may have heard about it. When Turiyanandaji, one of the prominent direct disciples of Sri Ramakrishna, passed away, he called his assistants and his disciples around him and asked them to repeat Brahma Satyam Jagat Satyam. So Brahma Satyam Jagat Satyam means Brahman is real, Jagat is also real from the experience point of view. Because experience is beyond philosophy. From a philosophical point of view, we may make this distinction. The world is mithya. It is just relativity. Brahman is only reality. But from the experience point of view, when the world is experienced, devoid of its name and form, then it is not different from Brahman. That is the meaning of Brahma Satyam Jagat Satyam. Brahman is real, world is real from the experience point of view. Brahman is real, world is relativity or mithya from the philosophical point of view. And of course, even if you don't go to that level, and from the common sense point of view, we can say this world is nothing but a manifestation of name and form. All these ideas are expounded here. Then in the next verse, yet sopma jagara susuptishu sat. That is one particular point. It is sat means absolute reality. Absolute reality, that's the meaning of the word sat. That which remains unchanging, without any change, in the three states of human experience, in the waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state. In the waking state, we experience things with the help of mind and senses of perception, senses of action. And in dream state, we experience things not in association with the senses of perception and senses of action. See, in waking state, you can walk in the park here. You use your eyes, which is sense of perception. You see things, you can hear things, and you can walk. Senses of actions are involved. And you use your mind also. So all these are involved in waking activities. But in dream, also you will walk in the Olima Park. But there, you may see trees and deers and bulls everywhere. But you are seeing them with your mental eye. Physical eye is closed. You are sleeping in pitch darkness. Still you see the sun blazing overhead. You can see the bulls moving, grazing everywhere. How do you see them? You see them as clearly as you see in broad daylight. But that daylight and that pair of eyes is a projection of mind based on the memories of experiences in waking state, which come to the surface and you relive, you re-experience those experiences when you are dreaming, though your eyes are closed and there is pitch darkness everywhere. So, these are three states. In waking state, you experience things at the gross level with senses of perception and senses of action and also mind. In dream state, you experience them at a subtle level, supma state. And in susupti state, you don't experience anything, but you do experience, and that experience is the experience of blissfulness, which is the result of complete identity between the seer and the seen, between the experiencer and the experienced. But you come to know of that blissful experience only when you return to the waking state, not when you are in deep sleep. In deep sleep, you are not aware of the great peaceful, tranquil experience that you are going through. But when you come out of sleep, you feel well, you had a wonderful sleep. So, there is a distinction between waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state. Now, the sage says, but this Atman as witness, the experiencer, the seer, the drashta, the subjects which is experiencing all this remains the same without any change. The seer is the same. It is Atman as the witness that enables you to experience things in waking states at the gross level, and the same Atman projects all these experiences in dream state And the same Atman enjoys tranquility and peace in deep sleep state. So, from the standpoint of the seer or experiencer or the subject or the drashta or sakshi, there is no difference. But there is a difference with regard to what is seen. With regard to the objects that are experienced, there is a difference. With regard to the subject who is experiencing, there is no distinction. Now, object is nothing but a projection of the subjects. It is just a mirror image. There are three important theories with regard to this subject, which I have no time to go through. Different schools of thought, three distinct schools of thought. We'll deal with it later in the interaction session if you want. Now, what Pipalayana says is this: this witness, this subject remains the same without any change in all the three avasthas, all the three states of waking, dream and deep sleep. So Sat means absolute reality, which remains unchanging in the waking, dream and deep sleep state. But then Behishta means different. That's the point, a technical point in Vedanta. If you say that Atman is the experiencer of waking experiences, and if you say Atman is the experiencer of the dream experiences, then you may have to admit that Atman gets involved in different experiences. Atman is not inseparably related to any of these activities. So to deny, to rule out that possibility of wrong interpretation, the great poet Vyasa used the word Behi, means it is different. The witness is experiencing everything, but the witness is not involved in the act of experiencing. It's a technical point. See, well, you are sitting there listening to this talk. If there is no Atman within you, you won't be able to sit and listen and use your intelligence to think and understand. It is the manifestation of Atman that enables you to think, to pursue, to understand and to cognize and to contemplate. But does it mean that Atman sits there? No. You are walking, you cannot walk. When the consciousness leaves the body, the person cannot walk. So when you walk, it is the presence of Atman within you that enables you to walk with your feet. But Atman doesn't walk. When you eat food, it is the presence of consciousness or Atman that enables you to eat food. But Atman doesn't eat food or lunch or breakfast. So in that respect, Atman as sakshi or witness, unrelated subject, exists everywhere. It is the presence of Atman that makes it possible for us to function in this world. But Atman itself is not in any way involved in any of these activities. For that point, the sage uses the word Bahi, means different, external. The point is this: Atman is not involved in any of these activities. But without Atman, you cannot function, you cannot get involved in any activities. So those who know this, Kena Upanishad begins with a question. Keneshidam patati preshidam manaha kena prana prathama praidi yukta. So a question arises. Who pursues your mind, your intelligence? Who directs your mind and intelligence towards different activities? Atman, the consciousness. Because without consciousness within, we cannot function. Many people die with all the senses intact. Something leaves the body and the person cannot see, and all the senses and mind, everything becomes inactive. So it is consciousness which enables us to function and which gives lives to all the senses. But at the same time, the consciousness is not directly involved in anything because it is distinct and different from all activities. Because if you say that Atman is involved in any activity, you have to admit Atman becomes conditioned. Atman becomes an agent of action. We say limitation. Atman is unlimited. So Atman as the all-pervading, immanent, transcendental reality is not involved in any of these activities, but without the immanence of this reality within, no one can function. This idea is brought clear in the second part of this verse, second line of this verse. Another point to remember is, the first verse. The first verse says, Atman or consciousness is the cause of the origination, existence and dissolution of the universe. Now all the scriptures, all the Vedas, all the Upanishads make one point, that Atman cannot be defined. If you define something, if you describe and explain something, you are limiting. You are limiting it within the four walls of definition or words. Anything which is subject to definition, verbalization or explanation is limited. If you say God has these qualities, what does it mean? God equals a being plus these qualities, which is you are giving and you are limiting God within an equation, which is a limitation. That God cannot be omnipotent, omnipresent or omniscient. So anything which could be confined within the four walls of definition cannot be infinite, cannot be eternal. But then what do the scriptures do? The scriptures indirectly point out the reality, not directly. So what is the absolute reality? One way of indirectly referring to the absolute reality is, the absolute reality is the cause of the origination, existence and dissolution of the universe. So that's the meaning. Yato va imani bhudani jayante yena jatani jivanti yat prayanti abhisambhisanti. This is an interesting episode, a small paragraph in the Taittiriya Upanishad. A small boy goes to his father, who is also his guru, and asks the question, please teach me the reality of Brahman. Just as this king Nimi asked Pipalayana. Now the father doesn't give a long talk. What he does is, you look around yourself, sees these mountains, valleys, trees, everything. Where do they come from? Do you know how they exist? And do you know what will happen to them in future? Try to find out this by meditation, through meditation. And the boy meditates. And after crossing four lower levels of understanding, ultimately the boy realizes that Brahman, or this reality, is the cause of the universe. So you can't say Brahman is this, the absolute reality is this. You can say the absolute reality is the original cause of the entire existence, which is a way of indirectly pointing out, not directly giving a definition. So that is the purpose of all scriptures. All the Upanishads, all the Vedantic scriptures tell us that we cannot explain the reality. Then why do we teach them? Why do we study them? To understand that is beyond definition. Unless you study the Upanishads, you will not understand that the absolute reality is beyond books. We will think absolute reality is something that we can explain, that we can define. So, indirectly we can point out, that aspect is brought out here. Then, Dehendriya Asukradayani Charantiyena Samjivitani Tat Avehi Param Narendra. I will explain this, of course. Now, then the sage says, this consciousness, this Atman, this Brahman, as the indweller, as the immanent principle within all living beings, gives life to all the senses, mind, intellect, and all the organs. That is the idea behind. Now, if you look at this 35th verse, there is one word used here, avehi. Avehi means, please understand, that's the meaning here. Please know. It's a bit technical, How can we use the word, please know Brahman? So, that point is dealt with in the next verse, the 36th verse, if you find, you can't hear. The 36th verse says, When we use the word no Brahman, it is only from a relative point of view. The absolute reality is beyond words, beyond ideas, beyond senses, beyond mind and beyond intellect. All these ideas are brought out in the 36th verse. You find Naidat Mano Vishati Va Uda Chakshuratma Pranendriyani Cha Yatha Nilamarchishu Swaha Shabdopi Bodhaka Nishedhayatma Moolam Arthoktamaha Yadrude Na Nishedha Siddhihi. The idea is this. This reality cannot be understood through mind or intellect or words or books or scriptures or philosophy or rituals, any of these things. And at the same time, this reality is explained in the Vedas. Now, this reality, in fact, it gives life to everything in this world, but it is not giving life to itself because it is life itself. The example is given here. Fire burns other objects, but the fire doesn't burn itself. Say, Yatha Anilam Archisha Swaha. See, the idea is this one. See, fire gives light to us. Fire burns other objects, but the fire doesn't give light to itself because it is by its very nature light itself. So this Brahman, this reality is self-effulgent. It is knowledge itself. It enables us to know other things, but it by itself doesn't become an object of knowledge. It is never objectified by knowledge. Because when you talk about spiritual knowledge, it doesn't mean that you are gaining a new knowledge. Rather, we are rediscovering our true nature. But there is always the limitation of language and philosophy, you know. So when we really know Brahman, when we really get spiritual enlightenment, we are not getting a new knowledge. What we are doing, it is a kind of spiritual homecoming. We are actually rediscovering our own true nature. Right now, we have many notions. We think we are this body. We associate ourselves with so many associations. Names, forms, nationality, geography, culture, language, and so on. All because we associate ourselves with many things other than the self or consciousness or Atman. So whenever we identify ourselves with this body, then a number of other associations will follow one after another. Number of other related associations. So they conceal our true identity. So when we remove these superimpositions, these false associations, these false cognitions, then what happens? The rest is our own true nature. I shall explain this again in the light of the analogy which is used in expounding this philosophical idea. You have to think of the room and an old rope lying in the room which somewhat coiled up, which resembles perhaps a snake or a curved stick or a crack on the floor or a thin stream of water. These are the four possible superimpositions. There could be many more, of course, used in scriptures. Now, four people have got four different notions with regard to what the object is because there is not enough light. The person who has seen a snake the previous day in a forest or a zoo may suddenly see, well, it is something like a snake that is lying in front of me. And the person who has seen a crack on the floor or any such things may think that, well, the object in front of me is a crack on the floor. Somebody who has seen a thin stream of water may feel, well, it may be a thin stream of water because there is not enough light. Now, if they bring light or if they open the doors and windows, what really happens? The rope doesn't come into existence. And the snakes and sticks and crack on the floor or thin streams of water do not vanish. What really happens? The false notions and ideas just vanish from their mind, not from the floor, because they do not exist there. So all these false ideas, wrong ideas, which are called superimpositions, just disappear from their mind. Now, do you require another agency to reveal the rope? You don't require. The moment you are free from the false notion that it is a snake, then what the object really is becomes obvious to you. It doesn't require another agency to reveal it. So books and scriptures do not reveal the reality. That is an interesting point in Vedanta. Books cannot and will not reveal the reality. Books only remove wrong notions. Just as the light that you bring to the room removes darkness. And when darkness disappears, the snake also goes away, because snake was a wrong notion. The snake is not driven out by light, because there is no snake. But the snake idea is, it goes away from the mind, because the darkness that was responsible, or the absence of light that was responsible for the snake idea is removed, the snake idea also goes away. When the cause is removed, effect also is removed. Similarly, when we read scriptures, any scripture, what happens is, the scriptures do not reveal truth. If anybody tells you that any scripture can give you the truth, that truth cannot be absolute eternal truth. Because that truth is the effect of your reading scripture. And anything which is the effect of any action cannot be eternal. That's an important point. Then what happens? The fact that it is a rope becomes a self-revealing truth. It reveals itself without the aid or help of any other agency. Similarly, through spiritual sadhana, through constant hearing, through constant introspection and contemplation, and continued spiritual effort, when we remove all these wrong notions from our mind, then the right notion will reveal by itself. Just as when the snake idea goes away, the rope idea naturally becomes obvious to us. This is what really happens. That is the meaning of the first two lines of the 36th verse. The verse literally says, this mind, this word, or the Vedas, or the eyes, or the word Atma is used in 36th verse. Atma here doesn't mean Atman, it means intellect. The word Atman doesn't mean Atma here. The word used is Atma. Naidat mano vishadi va uda chakshuhu Atma. Atma here doesn't mean Atman or Brahman, it means intellect. So this reality cannot be revealed either by mind or by words, by books or scriptures, or by the eyes or by the intellect, or by the vital energy or by the senses. Then what happens? It can only be realized when we remove the wrong notions. Then you see the third line, Shabdopi Bodhara Nishedhadayatma Moolam. Okay. Now Shabda here means Vedas. Well, you can say any scripture, any religious scripture belonging to any religious tradition. That's what is the implication of the word Shabda means. Any attempt to explain the reality. But in Vedantic tradition, it means the Vedas. It could mean any holy scripture. Now, when you read a holy scripture, a sacred scripture, all the wrong notions are removed. They are just negated. The right idea, the right knowledge comes by itself. The right knowledge is not objectified knowledge. It is knowledge itself. It is not the object of a subject. Any other knowledge, this glass becomes an object and I am the subject, the knower. And the act of knowing this glass is knowledge. Now, these three factors are there in any activity of cognition or recognition. The knower, the knowledge, and the object that is known, that is called known. But in spiritual knowledge, there is no such knower, known, and knowledge. Because ultimately, the knower realizes that what he is searching for is non-different from himself. This idea is very graphically described in one of the most famous Vedic mantras, which Swamiji refers to. You may have read in complete works. It is called the hymn of creation. It's called Nasadiya Sukta. In Sanskrit, it's called Srishti Suktam, or the Vedic mantra which deals with the mystery of this creation. Swami Vivekananda refers to this. Now the mantra begins something like, in the beginning there was neither existence nor non-existence. That's how it begins, Nasadasi, Nasadasi, Tadani, etc. I'm going to go into those details. But then, towards the middle part of this sukta, this hymn, there is an interesting portion. The sage goes in search of the truth, absolute reality. And he searches everywhere in the external world. But he fails to discover the truth that he's searching. And ultimately, as he goes on making intense effort to know the truth in the external world, his mind becomes more and more pure, and then ultimately he realizes that the truth that he's searching for lies within himself. It is within himself. Sato Bandhum Asadi Niravindan Hridi Pradeshya Kavayo Manisha. This is a particular mantra in the Rigvedic Sukta, in this particular Vedic mantra. The ancient sages went in search of the final cause of the universe, the absolute reality, God, let us say. They went in search of God. And ultimately, even after long efforts, they failed to discover this reality in the external world. But these efforts made them turn inward, because they failed to discover it in the external world. And when they turned inward, their mind became pure, and then they discovered that the reality that they were seeking actually exists within themselves. This is the central theme of that famous celebrated verse, very famous one. The sages searching for the reality in the external world ultimately turned their attention inward. This effort did not enable them to discover the truth, but it made their mind pure. Hridi Pradeshya Kavayo Manisha, through pure intellect, through purity of mind, they ultimately discovered that what they were looking for in the external world, in reality, is within their own hearts. And then they realized. And then, later on, they found the entire world is also a manifestation of that reality. So the immanent reality is the omnipresent, all-pervading reality too. This was the discovery. Now we will go to the next question. Sixth question. That is very important. It's a departure from the previous subjects. Now here, after listening for a long time to the sages' conversations and dialogues, the king felt that he may not be able to realize this absolute truth, because he had done so many deeds in the past which remain in their seed form in his mind. So there are so many memories, ideas, associations related to his previous life, previous activities, which are disturbing his mind, which create problems for his mind. So how can he meditate? How can he contemplate? Every time we try to contemplate, these disturbing thoughts and thought currents come to the surface of the mind and they create disturbances and obstacles. So how to get around this problem? For that, what is the way out? The great king Nimi already had read about Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga helps a person to become fit for the highest knowledge. So he wanted a detailed description of the subject. So he asked the question. You can see the 41st verse. Karma Yogam Vadada Na Purusho Yena Samskrita Vithu Yekashu Karmani Naishkarmyam Vindade Param. This is the question. Now, how do we attain purity of mind through disinterested action? He had heard about it. How do we attain that level of mental purity? And how do we progress in spiritual life, in this life itself, so that we can destroy the effects of unpleasant, undesirable deeds and attain purity of mind and then ultimately reach the spiritual goal? Because as I said earlier yesterday, our mind is like a bag. It is full of tendencies, impressions and impulses. These tendencies and impressions are the residual forms, the subtle remnants of all the deeds that we have done in the past. Deeds we have forgotten, but the attitude with which we have done these actions will register a strong memory in our mind. This will remain intact, and it is retained in the mind. And this bag of memories and tendencies is being carried on from life to life, like a relay run, you know, baton exchange. So in every new birth, you are bringing back the old bag of inherited, accumulated tendencies, impressions. So even when we try to lead spiritual life, there is an inherent, inexplicable backward pull. So it could take the form of procrastination, postponement, or an indifferent attitude. Not only obvious obstacles, but also sometimes an attempt to philosophize and justify our lethargy, spiritual lethargy. Why does this happen? That's because of the impact, the effect of these accumulated tendencies and impressions of previous life. If you have done a lot of spiritual practices, if not in this life, in some distant life, they will prompt us to take to spiritual life, to do practice, spiritual sadhana. But then we may have done certain other deeds which may not be spiritually beneficial. Those tendencies will pull our mind backward. So this struggle is often going on. Of course, this is only for sincere souls. Those who are interested in spiritual life alone will feel this struggle. Those who are happy with the world, they are also enjoying a kind of blissfulness. But that is the blissfulness of a brute. See, in fact, Swami Vivekananda says, yoga is an attempt, a conscious effort to speed up our evolution. That is one of the definitions that Swamiji gives to yoga. His revolutionary definition. Yoga is a conscious effort on our part to speed up evolution. See, only man can, or human beings alone can stand aside from the flow of, from the current of evolution and pause and think, well, where am I going? What am I doing? Where am I coming from? What's the meaning of this life I'm leading? These questions come only to some advanced souls. They alone face this struggle, these disturbances, these obstacles. Those who never take the trouble to stand aside from the common current, they won't feel it. It may take several more births for them to reach this level of evolution. See, it's like a flow. Now, if there is a current moving in one direction, if you just enter the river and stand still, the opposite current will take you in the opposite direction. So even to be able to keep status quo, you should exert some force. You should keep swimming. Then only you can remain in the same position, because the current is trying to take you in the opposite direction. And if you really want to move forward, then you have to work very hard. This effort to move forward, conscious effort, to fight against the natural current is the psychological explanation of yoga. This is what Swamiji says. There are two famous commentaries to Patanjali Yoga Sutra. One by Bhojavritti, the other is Vyasa's commentary. So, only those who really feel like entering the arena of spiritual life will feel this struggle and this conflict. Now, here the king is asking the question, please teach me the technique of Karma Yoga, which enables me to become fit, spiritually fit for the highest wisdom. In reply to this, in the 43rd verse, the sixth sage philosopher, Avirhotra, he answers. So here, karma akarma vikarmedi vedavado na laukikaha vedasya chisharasyatma tatra muhyanti sureha. He says there are three types of karma. One is karma means an action, deed, responsibility or duty that is normally sanctioned by scriptures and which everyone knows. See, there is an inherent spiritual mechanism within us which tells us that this is my duty, this is my appointed duty. A student's duty is to study and the teacher's duty is to teach. No one need to tell them. This is the natural responsibility. That's one interpretation of karma. Niyatam karma means a duty or responsibility which comes to you by virtue of your position in society or your profession or your sense of duty to yourself and to the rest of the world. That is one interpretation of karma. Then there is another. Vikarma means just the opposite. The opposite of one's sacred duty or responsibility. So a teacher who is supposed to teach, if he doesn't teach, he is practicing vikarma, means opposite of duty. Neglecting duty. Not only neglecting, but doing the opposite of it. If he tries to discourage students from studying, that is vikarma. This idea behind. There are people who, maybe not in teaching profession, but in other professions, they do practice the opposite of their appointed duties and responsibilities. Then third one is akarma, means completely abstaining from any activity. Complete lethargy, indifference, keeping oneself away from any kind of activity. There are three types of people in this world. Now, to understand the real nature of one's duty, one should know what is his own appointed duty and responsibility. The Vedas, for example, or any scripture may tell you, may ask you to do certain things with a definite motive in mind, because if you are taught at the beginning itself, if you are taught to do things without any purpose or motive behind, you may perhaps completely abstain from your duties and responsibilities. You may become completely lethargic and inactive, which is worse than doing some kind of activity. Therefore, to encourage people to encourage them to do something, the Vedas or scriptures sometimes enjoin us to do something, at least for namesake, for results. I shall explain this in the light of Gita, where it is given in a very elaborate style and language. Now, if you look at Gita, you find there are four stages in the evolution of karma. The same idea is put in a more graphic style. In the first chapter and up to the ninth verse of the second chapter, Arjuna is portrayed as a person trying to run away from his duty and responsibility. Now, not only that, he tries to justify his inaction. He tries to give a long philosophical justification for his inaction, trying to give false reasons for escaping from the field of duties and responsibilities. Now, how does Krishna react to this? Krishna doesn't ask Arjuna to practice karma yoga or disinterested action at the beginning itself. No. What Krishna does is first to pursue, to force Arjuna to give up inaction and do some kind of action, at least for the result. It's better to do something with a definite motive, ambition and desire than sitting quiet doing nothing. That's the first lesson given to Arjuna. So from a state of complete inaction, Krishna tries to raise Arjuna to the state of action with desire. Because some kind of activity is certainly better than complete inaction and inertia. So the first two stages are explained here. The state of complete inaction, akarma, and then a psychological condition in which Arjuna is asked to do his duty with a definite motive, a desire and ambition, because that's better than doing nothing. At the third stage, Arjuna is asked to do the same duty without desire. That's the third stage. Karma yoga is taught at the third stage. At the fourth stage, Arjuna is asked to get established himself in the karma yoga ideal, which will make him fit for the highest spiritual wisdom. See, this is the scheme that is followed in all scriptures, in Vedas also. That is what the great sage is trying to explain in a very brief paragraph. In fact, just a few lines are given, three four verses. In 3-4 verses, Avirhotra is trying to condense the whole philosophy of karma yoga, which is expounded in Gita, not only in the third chapter, which is karma yoga, but in many other verses as well. So these four stages of evolution of duty consciousness. First, one must try to shake off lethargy and inaction and practice action with desire, with ambition. And then he should try to get established himself in the higher path of action without desire, which is Nishkama Karma. At the fourth stage, he should become a yogi by practicing inward tranquility and outward action. All these verses, all these ideas are expounded in many, many verses in the Gita. Similarly, in the 44th verse, you can find Parokshavado Vedoyam Balanam Anushasanam. This is the meaning here. Vedas or Vedic scriptures, they do not teach things directly, because if Vedas were to teach you that you should practice disinterested action at the beginning itself, then people who cannot act without any motive will do nothing. If they want to do something, they need a goal to work for, a strong motive. Without that, they can't do work. There are people like that. If they are asked to practice disinterested action, they will simply keep quiet. They will do nothing. Therefore, to persuade them to do something, the Vedas ask them to do their duties and perform their responsibilities with some desire. You can go to Swarga, you can achieve this and that, etc. And then slowly, the scriptures take them to the next stage of disinterested action, and ultimately the highest spiritual wisdom. These ideas are expounded here. Now we will have interaction. So this is the last class. This is a very long subject, spread over so many chapters and over so many verses. I have tried, just made an attempt to condense some of these ideas within three classes, which is really some kind of an intellectual gymnastics. So I've just made an attempt to put together some ideas. So if you have got any questions, points to be clarified, I shall try to explain more. Thank you.
Jivatma. Angushta Matra, that says in the Karma Upanishad. That's the same, isn't it? It's the projection of Atman within everybody. Angushta Matra.
Oh, that is a symbolic presentation. Okay, right. You find many such symbolic presentations in the Purusha Sutta and all that. Those words should not be read literally. You should read the commentary, its English translation at least. And if possible, you should ask somebody, because these expressions were current in those days during the Vedic times. You can find many such expressions in the Purusha Sukta and all that.
So, all right, Maharaj. So we have the universal consciousness that we call Paramatma, and then when the body is there, prana is there, it resides inside us, and we call it Jivatma. Am I right?
Yes.
Now, in the course of journey, it takes gunas, all these three gunas. So, and then there is also the idea of ahankara, the attachment to something. How does this happen, Maharaj, mechanism? So, there is Jivatma, and there are these attributes, the three gunas, and then again, the ahankara, the ego. Atman has no ahankara. It has no attachment at all. So how does this
These senses, mind, which are associated with gunas, these are all vehicles. These are all media through which the Atman manifests. It's a bulb, you know. The electricity is not responsible if the bulb is red and the light is red. So depending upon the media or the medium through which it manifests, the effect will vary from person to person. So those who have got good samskaras, good tendencies because of their good deeds in the previous life or in this life, through them the same Atman manifests in sublime form. It is like a lake, you know. If the lake is pure, then the reflection of the sun will be clear. If the lake is muddy, if it is filthy, then it will be almost invisible. So, the manifestation of Atman, the manifestation of the reality, is in direct proportion to the clarity or cleanliness of our antakarna. So, the moment our mind becomes pure, it manifests in full splendor. So Swamiji says, you know, in this regard, he says, the difference between an amoeba and a Buddha is one of degrees, not of kind. See, Atman or the consciousness manifests in amoeba and also in a Buddha. Buddha corresponds to a spiritually enlightened person, and an amoeba, a primitive creature. In both, Atman manifests. How do you believe it? In amoeba at a very low degree, or in an evil person, or any person who is prone to do evil things, it manifests in a very low, in a very low degree. But it does manifest in a very low degree, and also it manifests through those instruments. If the mind is pure, if buddhi or intellect is pure, the manifestation also will be pure. So we should keep doing good things so that our mind becomes, intellect becomes pure, so that Atman's manifestation becomes more and more clearer. It is the same reality spread everywhere, the same energy. The energy, the form the energy takes depends upon the medium through which it functions. So, whatever we have got, whatever instruments we have got, we must try to put them into good, state of activity, which is which will be conducive to spiritual progress. That's why, you know, in our mind there are two bags: good tendencies, good impressions, good ideas. And also bad tendencies and bad impressions and bad ideas. Both are accumulated. Maybe not deliberately or consciously, but somehow they do exist. So when we try to do something really noble or good, there's a tendency to, well, I can do later on. Why can't do something else? Now, if you come in association with people who are equally interested in spiritual life, this association will strengthen the positive tendencies. If you come in association with another type of person, let us go to a nightclub, then you go there, that's also a place. But if you meet a good friend of yours, a spiritual seeker like you, let us go to a place which is spiritually helpful to us. Then we go to that action. So associations and contacts also either weaken or strengthen good and bad tendencies accumulated in mind. That's the purpose of strengthening and enriching positive tendencies and impressions. Constant reading. Somehow you have to read something, then read good things. You have to associate with people. You cannot keep your eyes closed. So try to associate with good people. And if there are people who may not be of a desirable type, yeah, just talk to them nicely, but see that they do not create, create a new tendency in your mind, which may be detrimental to your spiritual progress. Yatisharanji deals with this subject in the meditation spiritual practice. See, you cannot live in this world without coming in contact with people. And you cannot come in contact with people without any positive or negative influence registering in your mind. So try to see that only positive tendencies you develop. Negative tendencies, if they come, but better avoid or try to concentrate on enriching your mind with positive tendencies. That will make the mind clear and Atman will manifest in greater splendor. The manifestation or the intensity of manifestation of consciousness or Atman is in direct proportion to the clarity of our mind. Cleanliness of the mind means the purity of mind. It's in direct proportion to that. It's closely interrelated. If the bulb is clean, you get good light. Otherwise, that's it. You can never, that's why, you know, an interesting, you can never live in this world and interact with people with some kind of influence coming to your mind unless you are a Buddha. If you are an enlightened person, mentally you can keep yourself alert. So Yatisharanandaji uses the term a kind of spiritual filtering mechanism. Spiritual filtering mechanism. So keep a spiritual filtering mechanism within you. That's what Yatisharanandaji uses. These ideas are taken from Bhagavata Purana, also uses such terms in the number of dialogues you find. Keep spiritual, inner mechanism. We keep your mind in the right direction. That's the idea. That is the importance of Holy Company. Yesterday we were reading in the Isvaranji's book. Sinon, sir? Okay. Even this Bhagavata, for example, listening to these stories, you may think, well, it is a mythological story. But if you listen carefully and contemplate, then these ideas may come to the surface. And you are likely to take a copy of Bhagavata or any such scripture when you visit a library and let me have a look at this particular portion. See, that's the impact, that's the effect of it. This you may repeat again, any person, any spiritual seeker. If you read something else, that tendency also, the opposite, can also happen. So, it's purely psychological. I think you heard the story of Ajamila, which I mentioned earlier. Now, Ajamila was born to a pious family, and he was brought up by his pious parents, and he led a very good life when he was young. But later he started deviating from the path of virtuous life, and he had a fall. And towards the end of his life, he had become so depressed. He had squandered all the money. He had become completely isolated. But he suddenly remembered, in his helpless state, when he was about to die, he suddenly remembered his son. His son's name was Narayana, which is in Hindu tradition, it is a synonym of God. So this man called the name of his son, "Please come to me." So he was in a helpless state of mind when he was about to breathe his last. The boy came to him, but suddenly this man remembered, "But I was uttering the same name, as a sacred mantra during my younger days as a spiritual seeker." He remembered. His mind suddenly went back to his younger days, during which he was uttering the sacred mantra Narayana, the same name, but not as the name of his son, but as a synonym of God. So the days of his previous life, early days, his spiritual life, suddenly surfaced in his mind. And this, in addition to his totally helpless state, intensified his devotion. And at the end of his life, he had a peaceful death. That's how it means. So just imagine. So if a little bit of spiritual practice done any time comes to your rescue, if it is done in all sincerity, it will not be lost. In the sixth chapter, Krishna makes this point clear. Arjuna asks this question: what happens to somebody who gets lost in spiritual life? Ayadi sraddhayo pedo yoga charida manasaha. Aprapi yoga samsiddhim kam gadim Krishna gachchadi. Question is put to Krishna by Arjuna. Krishna was expounding dhyana yoga, how to meditate on God and so on. Then Arjuna puts a very natural question, which any spiritual seeker will ask. See, what happens to somebody who tries to practice spirituality, but then fails or faces a deviation from his path, or may die before attaining his goal? What happens to him? He will be lost, like a piece of cloud that gets separated from the mass of clouds, you know, which gets lost in his way. Then Krishna says, "Don't fear. There is no such thing as speech, any kind of good activities becoming absolutely useless. Even little bit of spirituality, spiritual practice will save you. Sarpam apyasya dharmasya trayate makato bhaya. Even little practice will come to your rescue. If you do it sincerely, then even if you forget it. Because this good practice, this spiritual practice will register a strong memory and tendency and impression in your mind. If not in this life, maybe next life, the same memory may come to the surface and may help you to continue your spiritual journey. So nothing will be lost and you are never late. That is the great promise of Vedanta. Even if you practice a little, it is still deposited in your name in the bank, spiritual bank. So you can draw your check next life or maybe late in later part of your life. So it will remain there. You won't lose anything. Remember, one important point is, in Vedanta, it is not that you have got just one life, one line. At the end of it, either hell or heaven. You either get lost to hell or heaven, nothing like that. In Vedantic tradition, your life continues. See, it's a terrible situation if you have got just one life. And if by mistake you do something wrong and if you are lost once for all, then it's something absolutely unbearable. It's a terrible fate. But Vedanta says nothing like that. Vedanta says you are never lost and this life is just a semicolon, a comma, not a full stop. It continues from where it ends. Death is only a semicolon. It is not a full stop. The journey continues. In Gita, in the second chapter, the beginning, 13th chapter, see, Dekhinosmi yatha dekhe kaumaram yavvanam jara tatha dekhantara praptihi dhiras tatrana mukhyadi. The central point is, wise man never worries about anything. Why? Because this body comes and goes. It is born, it is young, it is old, it dies, and then it is reborn. So where is, you are not going to lose anything. That is the distinct feature of Vedanta. Life is not one. That's the first principle you have to keep in mind. Vedanta tells you that life is not a single track. It is a cycle. So if you can practice a little in this life, if you meditate for half an hour in this life, which everyone must have done, then you will continue the same effort in next life. Because this effort will register a strong memory in your mind, which will come to the surface either later part of your life or next life, and you can continue your journey from where it ends in this life. That is the uniqueness of Krishna's message in Gita and also in Vedanta in general. In Bhagavata Purana, these ideas are expounded in very elaborate style, in the life, with the, so many stories and analogies from different scriptures.
Yes, Swami, you said, used the term, Brahman is life.
Brahman is?
Brahman is life. Oh. And so, can you say the same thing in reverse? Life is Brahman. The fact that there
yes,
is life.
Yes, yes, yes. What is consciousness? Whatever has got life, it is Brahman that is behind it. It is Brahman that gives life to everything. So life is Brahman. But life, I mean existence. Here, the word life is existence. In the Sat Chit Ananda, Sat is life, existence. That is Brahman. That is true. So, if you equate life with existence, absolute, then it is Brahman, of course. That's as far as words can expound it. It is beyond words, but still we have to use words because there can be no thought or contemplation without corresponding words. So words are used with the full recognition that words cannot exhaust or cannot fully define the reality, but words do try to expound it. The only words that we can use in describing Brahman is existence absolute, knowledge absolute, and bliss absolute. Here, existence is life, in fact. We have just a few more minutes.
Who is the author, Maharaj?
Author
Vyasa.
Text you are reading. Yes, Vyasa. Now, the whole text is a work of Vyasa.
Yes, Maharaj. But the publication.
Oh, the book which I have got is, it's not, you may, are not familiar. This is the Madras Math publication, oh. Tapasyanandaji's translation. But the book I was referring to is different. Translation. The whole text, yes. Yes.
Yeah, I see.
So, the two translations, yes. Tapasyanandaji Maharaj, translation of Bhagavata, published from Madras Math. The story of how this work came to be written, that also I would tell you. That may be appropriate in this context. Now, you know, this Vyasa was a great sage, and he was the one who actually edited the entire Vedic literature. Before Vyasa's period, the four Vedas, Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, and Athar Veda, they were just one work. Vyasa edited and classified this into four sections, which came to be known as Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, and Athar Veda. And he taught each of these four Vedas to one of his disciples. So he taught Rig Veda to his disciple Paila, Yajurveda to Vaishampayana, Samaveda to Jaimini, and Atharveda to Sumantu. Now, I am coming to another subject. So, Vyasa was a great scholar, great saint, a great master of all scriptures, but still, he had no peace of mind. He was the greatest philosopher of that age. He had no peace of mind. So one day he was sitting in his hermitage on the banks of the river Saraswati in a pensive mood. So immediately the one wandering ascetic Narada, the sage Narada, came there. So during their conversation, Narada asked him, "What's the matter with you? You are a great philosopher, an enlightened saint, still you are suffering. You seem to be in a pensive mood, you are very much worried. What's the matter with you?" Then Vyasa said, "Well, I don't know, but somehow I don't feel peace of mind. I don't know why." Then Narada told him, "There is a problem for you. See, in all the huge literary classics, in the Vedas, Mahabharata, and Vyasa wrote many smritis also, constitutions, code books, law codes. So you have just expounded dharma, and dharma is neutral, you know. Dharma, as interpreted, as expounded in the Mahabharata, is nothing but a kind of law. It's somewhat neutral. See, if you read Mahabharata, you find the great Yudhishthira, who was a great virtuous king, he had his own dharma. Arjuna had his own dharma. The villain Duryodhana had his own dharma. Duryodhana also gives long expositions of his own points of view. See, a constitution can be interpreted any way you like if you get a good advocate or attorney. Like that, the laws, do's and don'ts can be interpreted any way you like. So, you have not taught humanity what they should practice. So, you have not humanity what they should do in this Kali, in this Yuga, in this age. You have expounded, very broadly expounded, and given long descriptions of different do's and don'ts. Remember, the dharma that is mentioned here is not the dharma of the Buddhist tradition. The dharma that is mentioned in this particular context is do's and don'ts. Now, expounding a constitution or a law book, a set of do's and don'ts, won't satisfy somebody who wants to know, what should I do for my spiritual good? So, you do that. If you teach humanity the path to spiritual life, to the ultimate spiritual good, then you will have peace of mind, not otherwise. And in response to this suggestion, Vyasa started writing Bhagavad Purana. The greatness of Bhagavad Purana is, though it is a narration of the life and activities of Lord Krishna, it also tells you what you should do, how you should lead a spiritual life in this world. It is much more intimate. It comes down very close to the hearts of a common seeker in this world. It doesn't just give you a philosophy of life, as Mahabharata did, or other works of Vyasa did, Brahma Sutra Shishika. In Bhagavad Purana, Vyasa tells you how and why you should lead a spiritual life in this world. So, in a spiritual way, it is very intimate. It comes very close to our hearts. And after writing this book, he enjoyed peace of mind. That is the uniqueness of this story. And there is a long description of why Vyasa did not enjoy peace of mind before he wrote this book. Narada gives an example. See, you wrote about dharma. You wrote about the histories and lineages of different kings and emperors and kingdoms. And you expounded do's and don'ts. But they are not very definite. As I said, you know, a constitution can be stretched in any direction you like. It is so flexible, so elastic. But there is a spiritual message which a spiritual seeker is in need of, that you try to expound in a separate book. In response to this suggestion, Vyasa wrote this Bhagavad Purana. So that's why this book is known as a great, as a source of peace and spiritual consolation, and is read as a sacred book every day by millions of believers, as a sacred book. Mahabharata is not read that way, but Bhagavad Purana is expounded as a sacred text by scholars and also saints and sages. And is read every day as a sacred book by millions of people for the last several centuries. That is the uniqueness of this book. So now we have come to the end of this session.
Alright. So this could be, we can define this as Sanatana Dharma, which defines the do's and don'ts.
No, it is not Sanatana, it is Bhagavata Dharma. Bhagavata Dharma is different from Sanatana Dharma. Bhagavata Dharma is the spiritual core of Sanatana Dharma, because it tells you what you should do. That's the, and then it gives you the story of the incarnations of Lord Vishnu and different spiritual ideas. It's very intimate. It comes down to the level of the common spiritual aspirant seeker and lifts him to a higher level of spiritual sadhana. That is the uniqueness of this book. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa.